Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is William from Future War Stories, and we are going to be discussing Joe Haldeman's The Forever War, which won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1976. So, William, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk about one of the founding classics of military science fiction and a book I personally really love.
Awesome. Yeah, and we've been trying to get this scheduled for a while, so I'm glad we were able to work it out.
I'm so sorry. My life has been super crazy. I don't recommend buying a house and starting a teaching job within the same month. Don't recommend it.
No worries, man. I'm glad we were able to do it. So why don't you talk a bit about Future War Stories?
Future War Stories was founded in 2010, and I am the founder and the editor-in-chief. I'm the majority writer, but I have a few other people that write, including my chief contributor, Yoel, who contributes a lot of amazing articles on firearms. He's a wonderful individual and does a lot for Future War Stories. It was founded because I was writing a military science fiction novel, and I couldn't find being surrounded by the military my entire life, but not being military. There were things I couldn't find, things I couldn't understand, especially from a writer's point of view. And so I decided that I would start something that would not only promote my writing, but the genre and Future War Stories. I went through a couple names, and then I settled on this and settled on Blogger because it was free and, well, you know, can't invest too much if it's never going to pay anything back. And it took off. Yeah. And so it became, and I'm a trained researcher. I have a degree in history. And so I dug into this, and it became a consuming passion that, you know, how does a plasma weapon, how would it really work? What's a laser really do? You know, how would you get from orbit to ground? What about Mecca? What would that really look like? And, you know, how do you actually go on patrol? What does that really mean when people say that? So it's been like that. And it's, we passed 5 million page views this summer. And awesome. Future War Stories has become basically the number one site in the world for information on military science fiction. I would love to launch, you know, and do different things with it, but it's really time constraints. But this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about a great book with someone who's really passionate. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. I can't remember how I came across you. I think I was Googling about something and came across one of your articles and just filled out your either a comment or a contact form or something and said, hey, do you ever do any podcasting? So,
yeah, I think you actually commented on one of my little sections. I actually just found like, what about this blog? And you filled it out. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. Fantastic.
Yeah. So you want to talk a little bit about sort of what I call your nerdy history, right? Like how, your science fiction fandom, where's that come from?
I want to say maybe conception. It's been weird because I was born in 1976, the year that the Forever War won. It's, you know, it's Hugo. So interesting enough. And I, of course, share the same. You know, my first name is William, and there's a little quinky dinks with that, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And my first movie I ever saw in the theater was the motion picture, Star Wars, Star Trek, the motion picture. And I fell asleep during it, like most people do. And I think they used that to torture prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, I think. And so I grew up watching, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars, Buck Rogers. But because I lived in Dallas in my early years, they aired the second wave of anime that came over here, like Star Blazers, Battle of the Planets, Gundam. And I watched that at like the age of like 2 or 3, and it had a profound effect on me. And then by 1985, I was watching Robotech, which completely blew the lid off. When my friends were talking about like great 80s cartoons, like Transformers, I'm like, well, there's this show called Robotech, and it's much more awesome. And I was defending it and talking about it. And I think this was the first intro to what I was end up doing with part of my life. But, you know, I came at a great time, and the 80s was filled with, you know, great board games, D&D, you know, role-playing games and board games. And I was playing CityTech, BattleTech, D&D as a kid. And so, you know, this geekdom, watching Star Trek The Next Generation and Captain Power and things like that. And it just became this instant love. And it was so organic. And military science fiction, which I didn't realize, was always in the background of my life. And it wasn't until I really watched, until I played Halo and I watched Starship Troopers, that I began to realize this genre existed. So I would have been kind of, I have a t-shirt that says geeked for life, because that has been who I am. I can't escape it. I cannot run it. It's who I am. And you can't outrun who you really are.
It's true.
But it was an amazing time. I think the 80s were a really important time to forge a whole new era in science fiction. And I was really grateful. I was a kid during that time period and bought the great comics, you know, played the great games before it became all video games and those kind of things. It was a kind of a very primitive but honest kind of time. And that's kind of my geek history.
Nice.
And, you know, even this day, I still try to keep up with my little corner of it. And it's an amazing time. It's amazing to me that, you know, as a kid, I watched Doctor Who, but you couldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Because you had to be in the dark about it. No one knew who the X-Men were except for us people going to comic book stores.
Right.
You know, and I grew up in Northern Oklahoma. And so, you know, no one had this. But today, because I teach, I see kids walking around with like Avenger backpacks. And, you know, the coolest kids are wearing Avenger and talking about the latest movies. I'm like, and they're buying anime and talking about anime. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know what? You're all welcome. Because we did that for you. I suffered being stuffed in the lockers because of you. For you.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about this book and why this book in particular. Because, you know, you had the whole list of Hugo winners to choose from. Why this one?
The Forever War occupies one of the most important places in military science fiction. The founding literary element of military science fiction is 1959 Starship Troopers. But I think, and I've argued this, and I gave the Forever War the Masterworks of Literature Award for being the best military science fiction book in existence, because it is just that. It's much more honest and realistic. And the Forever War is a book, once you read it, you never forget it. Even if you only read it once, it's so dynamic and so different than anything that was written. You know, science fiction went on a revolution after Star Wars, and everyone, from film, book, TV, you name it, video games, all were trying to copy that. And the Forever War is like an echo of the future. You know, a book that was trying to tell a very gritty story that only now science fiction in the last 10 years has been trying to tell. And, you know, Joe had it before, and he was writing from a very honest place, and you can feel that in his writing. The Forever War is an incredible book. It's of its time, but not. And if you know about the man, and him being a veteran and serving at a very critical time in our country, in a very odd, in a war that defined a generation and still defines us, you know, he took a lot of his experience, I think, cathartically, and put him into the Forever War.
Yeah.
And you can see it, and you can feel it. And I think it's a great book for that. I think it's a great talking point. And I think the alienation that comes with that disconnect from service, can this book can sort of explain.
Yeah. So kind of moving into non-spoiler discussion, I'm going to stay pretty spoiler light here. Can you give like a quick elevator pitch for the book, or like quick non-spoiler synopsis kind of thing?
All right. What would happen if we never talked to our enemy and we flung some of our brightest and best way out into the darkness to fight an enemy we never talked to? And those soldiers come back, not aging, but the world has aged around them. And yet their enemy comes from the future as we come from the past. And how do these soldiers that fight in this eternal conflict, how do they change? Are they more alien than the aliens they fight? And that's the struggle that Mary Gay Potter and William Mandela experience. Revolutionary novel. What could happen? And in some ways, what must not happen.
Nice.
I think that's my elevator pitch. I've been practicing that.
Awesome. No, I like that. So just kind of by way of overall thoughts, this was a reread for me. One that I read, 2015, a number of years ago, for the first time. And so I was glad to come back to it again here, because it was definitely one, like you said earlier, that had stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Funny thing is, I read it just a couple months away from reading Old Man's War. And so there's a couple places where there's scenes that will come into my head and I'm like, no, was that one from Old Man's War or was that from The Forever War?
Yeah.
And they're very different books. And so you'd think that wouldn't happen, but I think just the fact that they're the same genre kind of smashes them together in my mind.
And I think for a lot of other people, because without Starship Troopers, you can't have The Forever War. And without The Forever War, you can't have Old Man's War. And every author, including myself, has tried to write that powered armor versus alien book. And mm-hmm. Old Man's War is kind of a response to both of these books. And I know Armor by John Stakely, who's a local Texas author who died, he wrote a book responding to the lack of action in Starship Troopers. So I think a lot of people in military science fiction, they take that Starship Troopers book and then they like put it in a different frame of mind. I don't really know if the author has ever read Starship Troopers. I'd be curious to ask him that. But I think The Forever War is a novel that, you're right, it does mirror and it does have a huge impact on people that write within genre. I know that I read it when I was founding Future War Stories and I was like, my God, you know, if I can ever write to this level. That's interesting. I'd like to read them back to back now. Now you're really curious. I want to do that project. I want to read them back to back.
All right. Just kind of other non-spoiler topics, anything you want to talk about before we get into hard spoilers?
The non-spoiler for me, when you think about this book and when you write about this book and you live with this book, because it lives in your mind afterwards, I think is the skill that the author put real science into it. And the term hard science, I know a lot of people apply that to Star Trek, and I don't think they understand that Star Trek is it's kind of self-serve hard science fiction. But The Forever War puts things in perspective. You know, I think the thing that will stay with you with this book is how these soldiers come home, mm-hmm. how the war is fought, and the honesty that with the dialogue and what he experienced in Vietnam and how that translates to this. You know, I was listening to a section today where the soldiers are complaining about things that probably the Romans complained about. And I thought there's a lot of honesty in those discussions. And of course, it's some of the situations he puts the soldiers into, especially some of the, well, we'll get that more in the spoilers, I think, but some of his rotations and some of his other things. I thought, wow, this was a book really of its time, you know? But
I'm a sucker for a book that, you know, tries to be, I won't say hard science fiction because, you know, strictly speaking, hard science fiction shouldn't have something like any faster than light travel or anything like that.
No.
But I like when something like time dilation is taken into account and there's real consequences for it, because like, it's a cool idea to think about surviving into the far future and experiencing that, you know, experiencing what the future is like. But this book really lays to rest any notion that such an experience would actually be all fun and games.
Yeah.
Because of the changes in society that you're not necessarily. And it's interesting, there is as an allegory to the soldier's experience going to war and coming home and finding that society isn't, you know, necessarily what he needs it to be or what he thought it was when he went to war.
Exactly. And you have soldiers that made terms in Vietnam that left before the Summer of Love and came back. And I've read accounts from them and even the author himself who wrote a book about his experiences in Vietnam. And when I was re-listening to those parts in the books, because there's a lot of focus on that first part and not as much on the back end of it. Because a lot of people, in fact, I think the movie that they're thinking about doing for this is basically they go on the first campaign through the first Collapsar. I think on either its anniversary or Earth's Hope is the name of the ship they travel in. Anyway, and they come back and of course things have irrevocably changed and William and Mary Gay meet their parents as much older people, even though that in some ways they are actually older than them when they left. It's kind of strange the way it kind of boggles the mind when you think about time dilation in terms of this. And I was shocked reading that, what was in there. And I think if you were a soldier in Vietnam and you came back and, well, let's say you flew into San Francisco and there's the height of the counterculture movement, I mean, what would that look like? That would look like an alien reality, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what he got to experience. And it's really wonderful in the book. And so with the movie, I think that's all they're going to do. I think they're going to go out and they're going to come back and Earth is going to be changed. As far as I know, I think that's all they're going to do with the movie from the spoilers and things that have kind of come out about it. I hope not. But that's what I think they're going to do, because I think that's the angle. And I think The Forever War is much more than that. And I think if you're thinking about reading this book, I think you read it for the honesty in the pages. The important book that establishes that tradition of powered armor, the fighting suits. Mm-hmm. I think his approach was really honest too. The perils of high technology and the disconnect it can breed with soldiers in combat. But then there's the honesty of combat and what it does and what it does to you. It's hard not to talk about spoilers, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's always a delicate game trying to dance around them a little bit just to try and entice anybody who's listening, who's like, I've never read it, and I want to decide if I want to actually read it. So and yet I know, you know, I've had listeners say, hey, you know, I listen to every episode all the way through, just counting on my the memory of any details that you talk about going away before I actually get around to reading it. So
Yeah, there we go. That'd be a challenge, because this book does have some twists and turns in it. But I think anyone that wants to read this book, it's enjoyable again and again. There are things about it that I pick up every time I read it, especially different my frame of mind of what I'm looking for to get out of it. I've read it, I said, about six times. I read it the first time. I read it a second time at my dad's bedside in a hospital. And I got a different experience out of it. And there's even, and now that it's out in comic book form by a major publisher, you're not having to spend $100 tracking down all three graphic novels that were published in the 90s. I mean, in 90, you know, it's becoming much more accessible for people.
Yeah, I don't think I even knew that the graphic novel adaptation existed.
Until now?
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I think I saw something on your site about it.
Yeah, there are actually three of them that existed. That exist, that came out in a Belgian publisher and a Belgian artist, Mervano, actually did the art, and it's very organic and earthy looking. And Joe Hahnemann actually signed off on it, and it was published in Europe first in like 88, 89. And then it was imported here to the United States by NBM, who still exists today. And they brought them over in a 3-part series of large, and they're like old school graphic novels, so they're big. They brought over in a 3-part series, and the first one was celebrated. That's actually how I know about the Forever War. I guess we can, you know, if you want to dive into that a little bit, it's kind of a weird little story.
Yeah, but, go for it.
So the first graphic novel features the first campaign. And when I was in a comic book shop, they used to publish a thing called the comic book shop newsletter, and you'd pick up free. And I remember there was this image, and they said, European military science fiction book published in comic book form in Europe coming to America. And I read it, and I remember I had this image of William in a, you know, a combat spacesuit with like space shuttles behind him. And I was like, wow, called the Forever War. I'm like, and you know, at the time, this is the 80s, and I'm like, that is so cool, right? You know, look at that laser gun. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. And that image stuck with me. And then later when I moved to Fort Worth, I found it in a comic book shop, and it was expensive. And then I found out it was a book, and I found out I should read it. And I did. And then when I started Future War Stories, I came across a big comic book store exists here in Arlington, actually right where I live. And I bought the first edition for almost nothing. They went down in value. And that was my very first post ever on Future War Stories. And they had 8 copies. Nice. And they sold out of them. Like the guy, I remember the guy that I was talking about, the guy who goes, you're that guy who did the article on it. I'm like, yeah. He goes, yeah, we sold out of them in 3 days. We've had that stock for years. He goes, you sold them all. You want to do some articles on other slow selling comics? Yeah. I was like, okay.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up on Comixology. So it's available there in electronic. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
And what's weird is Titan Comics has re-released it, and they released the sequel Forever Free. And when you get around, when your site gets around to doing that, those graphic novels are now out, and they were only published in Europe, in France. You couldn't even get them. And the cool thing is that Titan has published all of them, and they kept the original art. It's not redone. It's like original. So I feel like a sucker paying so much money for the second volume and the third volume now. I could have waited. But that allows people access, and it's a fairly well-done adaptation of it. And I was rereading them today. And what's interesting is that I think the Forever War broadcast to anyone that wants to read these, the honesty in a soldier's life and the sacrifices that they make, whether in some desert, some jungle, or on way out there on some off-world site fighting, you know, alien bugs and 10-foot mud or whatever, that honesty is expressed.
Yeah.
In the writing. And I think it's something that you can pick up in the Colonial Marines from Aliens or the Marines in Space Above and Beyond. You can pick up the honesty. And I think Forever War occupies that perspective. And anyone who wants to read this book, they can get that. I think that's an amazing part. The journey, the soldier's journey is really explored in this book.
Yeah. Well, so one last thing before we get into spoiler talk. If you were going to recommend this novel to somebody, on kind of on what basis would you recommend it? And you've already been over some of it, so we don't have to dwell over long on it. But you know, I wrote down here, let William take this one.
I would recommend this book to anyone that wants to get a gritty experience with science fiction. You know, I think too much of military science fiction sometimes can look like Star Trek or Star Wars.
Sure.
Yeah, Star Wars has gotten a little bit gritty with Rogue One and Solo and that kind of thing. But, you know, before there can be this plastic, fantastic reality to future war. But the Forever War, when I read it, I was like, oh my God, he really did something here unique. And in the 70s, I mean, the book was written around 74, published in 75, and one in 76. You know, at that time, science fiction had yet to make that big change. It was still a little bit psychedelic, you know. And then by the time Star Wars rolls around, it changes. But the Forever War, I think for people, they want that experience of reading a book that will change them, that will make them appreciate the world they live in, that will make them think about how we change, how we could change, and should we actually, if collapsers, you know, actually exist and we can navigate them, should we send people out to fight?
Right.
Should that actually exist? And this book is, in addition, it'll give you a really great crash course in physics. I learned so much reading this book. I was like, I don't understand some of this. I'm going to have to get a book. And I had to get it, you know. And that was the amazing thing. And he makes it palatable. He makes those kind of things exciting. You're like, wow, I never knew this. That's how you apply this. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the combat scenes that are not on planet, that are in space, they're very horrifying. The line between life and death in space combat.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think it's time to get into spoiler talk.
Now it can be unleashed.
Yes. So the one thing that kind of I'd written down about, you know, that I wanted to talk about in spoilers is just, you hinted at it, the just kind of some of the absurdity of war on the scale of galactic, you know, and sending out soldiers against an enemy that, you know, you just kind of have to assume that the other side isn't going to quit this war. And so you continue contesting her, and that's, just a self-sustaining thing at some point. And of course, at the end, you find out it wasn't really based on anything. It was based on a misunderstanding. And it's part of the absurdity of war in general, right? I look at the world and I look at science fiction that's utopian and I think, yeah, but we're never going to get that. We're too stupid. We keep getting into wars for no reason. And
yeah.
Yeah. So it on one hand, it's depressing. On the other hand, you know, you need fiction to bring that kind of stuff up.
I think that's a really great point, because science fiction at one time was meant to be escapism. But one of the great founders of science fiction, especially military science fiction, is H.G. Wells. Mm-hmm. War of the Worlds is kind of a depressing but very honest story. Yep. Man's all their machines fail them, but yet the smallest creatures defeated the Martians.
Right.
And, you know, the eternal war that lasted 1,033 years was fought over a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Why did you start the war? Us, I think, is actually the exact line out of the book when the cloned man species off of Khan, I believe was a soldier's name, that they're all patterned after. Mm-hmm. This is deep in the back of the book, which most people, as I think the discussion about this book is always a lot of times the very first part of it.
Yes.
When they come back from the first mission. But then I find the book to be much more interesting later on. Especially in the book, I will be honest, and I should probably mention this non-spoiler, but I cried at the end of this book first time I read it. Honestly, I know that I write a military science fiction site, and it's supposed to be all manly. I cried. The letter that's written from about the birth of Mary Gay, when Mary Gay writes that letter to William, I think that should be a Walt Whitman's test, whether you're a replicant, should be on the void comp test. You know, if you're a replicant or a human, I think Deckard or Kay should have used that on the void comp test.
Yeah, yeah.
Is extremely well written. And I know his wife is named Mary Gay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he was definitely channeling her. Mm-hmm. I think the back, you know, that absurdity of war, the two colonial ships that go down and start this war, and you know, how the best and the brightest of humanity are, you know, taken off for the expedition force. And so humanity alters. I mean, their entire economy goes, they fight that war. What, in 2007, I believe, and they fight, and then there are the calorie, the worldwide rationing, you know, you have this, and it's funny, I was listening to today, that section, and I thought, there's a few things he got right.
Sure.
There are a few things that have changed, and then, of course, the government now wanting homosexuality, which I find very funny, considering, you know, the fight against exception, and it's been funny, oh, now we want that because we want control, and every time that William comes back to the Stargate and comes back, you know, his soldiers are so different. And he's what called the old queer through part of the book.
Right.
Because he's hetero. Mm-hmm. And the planet the heteros live on is middle finger. I mean, it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And the relationship between him and Mary Gay is the anchor to their entire life. And yes. I probably should put that on spoilers. Now I'm really, you know, thinking about this. They're the anchor to each other. Their entire world changes, but they're each other's world, even despite the rotations, which is really shocking in the book. I don't know about your perspective, but, you know, in Vietnam, there's a lot of drug use among the soldiers. Right. And of course, right. And he includes them doing dope. And at one point, I know at one point they get back and then you can legally use heroin in the officer's bar. I was like, whoa, I've totally forgot about that. And I was like shocked. And then they had the rotation schedule for bed partners.
Yeah.
I was pretty like, I don't think that's ever going to happen, but it was fascinating to get a Vietnam veteran's perspective on that and have him put that in there. And that lasts quite some time in the book.
Yes.
You know, that kind of absurdity.
Yeah. And I was wondering about that the first time I read it. Like, is this, you know, because this is, there's the Elite Conscription Act, right? So it's not like these are folks who had set out for a career in the military. Mm-hmm. They're pulled in because of their expertise in, you know, in whatever area. And I guess they throw that to them as a benefit, but I also love the fact that kind of almost the first time we're introduced to that concept, that their bed partners rotate, and it's with William, with Mandela kind of saying, why is it that you always, when you don't, you're not in the mood, you get the partner who's really up for it, and when you are, you get the partner who's
not. Yeah, I remember that. That was great. That's when I think they're in Missouri doing their basic before they're shipped off to that planetoid chartering. He actually wrote this book before they discovered the moon of Pluto.
Right.
Which I didn't. Yeah, I thought that was funny. You know. Yeah, that was fascinating. I don't know because I've never met the author, but there are some things I'd love to talk to him about. And I'd be like, was this satirical? Was this something you thought might be a cure? Or why? Like, you know, I think you'd have an advanced degree and an IQ of 150 to be into the Elite Conscription Act, because they wanted people that were able to kind of like, I think like proto Starfleet, they wanted, you know, very educated people to solve problems, and they didn't have a tricorder or data to pull up the information. And, you know, depending on what version you read, because there are multiple versions of it, you know, there's parts of it that don't exist in the original version.
Can you elaborate on that? Cause I had read that there was more than one version, and I'm curious, what is different?
Well, according to what I remember, the original version that was published in 75, I know that does not include the battle at Mary Gay's parents' commune farm, I think in one of the Dakotas, I think it's where they are.
Okay.
And that section doesn't exist in the original publication. And then the problem is they inserted it, I think, in the 91 version, and then the author had to go back and kind of rework because it didn't work with a new edit. They just sandwiched it together, and he's like, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the covering art is always changed. There's a fun game to your audience. They ought to look up how many different cover arts and how interesting they are to the Forever War. They're fascinating. The international copies are fantastic. One of my goals is to collect some of them, because the Japanese version is awesome. Anyway, that's what one of the things that happened. And it's been slowly, in 2003, the EOS version with the guy with the eye patch, I think, is the very first one that was put together and done properly. Mm-hmm. That's the one I own. And now I think that's the version that's now being published. And I think there are a couple other subtle, but I know that the major section is when they go back to Earth the first time, that they leave out that battle. And it's kind of a little Mad Maxian, I think, the first time around. I was like, this almost doesn't belong. Yeah, I thought it was weird.
Yeah.
Good weird, but still like a sec where I'm like, why is this in here?
Yeah. Well, kind of talking about that, I wanted to mention that, you know, this is a military science fiction book. And so there are some battle scenes, both in sort of space combat and then on planet side combat. And they're terrific. I think those scenes are great.
But they are.
Like, that's not the majority of the book, to my mind. Like, the stuff about the soldier returning home, that's kind of the core of the book to me.
It's more about William and Mary Gay becoming more and more alien.
Yeah.
Kind of a stranger in a strange land, but you still have to fight for him. And I often wonder about the motivation of the soldiers. When I was rereading parts of the book and I was reading the graphic novels, I kept thinking, what is their motivation at this point?
Yeah.
You know, soldiers fight for each other, mostly, not country. I think when he and Mary Gay are separate, I think that was the book is agonizing in detail over that. And you're right, most of the book is not. But, you know, soldiers say, as William says to his mother's bodyguard, what was it like? Mostly boring and then terrifying.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always heard. Mm-hmm. And that book, you know, there's combat. And the combat gets stranger as the book goes on. It's very honest at first. You know, they slaughter them in the first encounter. because this alien species, Torn. I always pronounce it wrong. The Torns were not warriors, and so they use that bubble machine. They're very odd looking. They're not pictured in the graphic novel correctly to the description of the author. They're totally different, which I think is a major problem with the graphic novel. But anyway, you know, they use that bubble, which is not seen in the graphic novel, and you're like, wow, that's really just coolly alien, this way this weapon system works.
Yeah.
And it just like kills some of them in like horrible ways, but then they just slaughter them easily. And his descriptions of what the lasers do, like chopping the quivering meat, I remember it was one line I listened to, and I thought, wow, that is incredible writing. Mm-hmm. And the inhumanity makes them sick, and only through that hypnosis that they're able to get through it. And I know they wonder aloud a lot, like, oh, does hypnosis make us realist? Is that what's going to make us do
right? Yeah, and in many ways, I think that hypnosis thing is, you know, that makes it easier for them to kill. But is that okay to do? Because I don't think it is, right? Because it's the soldier has his work to do, and it's grim work, and kind of sheltering him from that, from how grim it really is. I understand that makes him more effective, but it takes away some of his humanity.
And that was, you know, I think when the author was writing this, Joe was writing this, I think he was thinking about all the post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, I think when people read this book and when your audience, they need to keep in mind the historical context this book was written in. Mm-hmm. This was written when you had an entire generation that was at home and who had served were suffering from psychological scars. And maybe in his mind, he thought if we could cut down on shell shock, as it used to be known, if we can cut down on that by using some sort of, you know, new age mental technique to make it easier to lose humanity and to kill like an animal, then maybe it would make it easier for soldiers to come home. Mm-hmm. And I think that was part of his point. It's not as well established as I wish it had been. I think he kind of loses that point through the book, but it is pretty powerful, especially in the beginning. I was like, wow, that is really something. And they do future conditioning through that combat VR program they make him do later on. I know, you know, and that's really mentioned in Mary Gay's The Separate Tale book that Alderman wrote. About, you know, her experience is separate from William when he's on that campaign where he goes out, what, takes him 300 years to get out there. When they go out to the last campaign out the, 148,000 light years, I think is how far it goes out. In the very last campaign. The one of the things about the book, I was really weird, and I don't discuss this book with many people because most people have never read it. They're in my orbit. The stasis field, I thought, was a very strange choice. And I've wondered about that. And I wondered about why he did that. I think he was trying to make a point about the quote from Einstein. You know, Third World War, I don't know what weapons the Third World War will be used, but the Fourth War will be used with clubs and sticks and stones. Right. And I don't know if that's what he was trying to say. But I found the stasis field to be strange and the Nova bombs. I found the whole battle to be almost surreal. And it's well written, of course, and very brutal and very honest, but still it was strange. I don't know what you thought about it, but
yeah, actually I had forgotten about it, and when you mentioned stasis fields, I it took me a minute to remember what that was. But it's just kind of the concept that your weapons evolve and your tactics have to evolve because of that. And you know, the kind of, you have the stasis fields and the Nova bombs, and they're kind of two sides to the coin, right? If I'm remembering it correctly, the stasis field is if your group is inside that, you're protected entirely. But then the Nova bomb goes off outside,
and then if your enemy comes in, you engage in bow and arrows and, you know, in a sword fight, because the nothing electronic can be used. And I don't know why they didn't use gunpowder weapons. I think he really wanted to make a point. And that image of an astronaut using a sword appears actually in the cover art of the board game that exists. But that image has populated. And it's such a small part of the book, but it's so unusual. And I think he was making some sort of statement. So I've never talked to him. And most people don't always want to talk about one part of it. And to me, as I said, the latter part of the book is the really most interesting thing. And I found the planet of heaven, the recovery planet, also to be an interesting part of the book that isn't often discussed.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that you have the, because of the time dilation, you have the concept of, okay, we're going out in our state-of-the-art ship, and we're hoping that we encounter one of their state-of-the-art ships that's earlier than ours, because if they're more advanced than we are, we're screwed. But there was also the, okay, we've gotten wounded in combat. You know, I've lost a leg. I can't remember. Did she lose an arm? something like that.
She loses an arm, he loses a leg, and that, I think it's tattoo campaign.
Right. And so they're prepared for what the sort of state-of-the-art medicine can do for them. And then they head off and they do their collapsar jump, go through whatever, Stargate or whatever, and then arrive at heaven and find out, oh no, we can grow you a new, we can build you a new.
Yeah. It's Future Shock. They mention it in there. I think during the battle when actually the enemy premieres a new weapon and actually damages it, nearly kills Marigay. And they're like, this weapon is close to relativistic speeds and we don't have anything against it. But see, next time we'll be in the technological advantage because of it's almost like time travel war. That concept is so not discussed enough about this book. And it will boggle the mind when you think about it, because it would put things like, if you look at something like Star Trek, you know, the Enterprise A shows up and, you know, a Romulan warbird, and they're so vastly unmatched. But here was a state-of-the-art ship in Kirk's time facing off what Picard would face. And that is so incredibly unfair, you know, to whoever's on the opposite side of it. But it's the nature of war. And especially when you start dealing with this. And it was weird, like, that as they came back, that base got bigger and bigger. And then, you know, heaven didn't exist. And now it exists. And it's like this utopia almost. The soldiers can go and enjoy things and enjoy and recover and be in a world that is for them, by them, I think is what I was taken away from that. You know, soldiers talk about, Roman soldiers, if I remember the line correctly, they used to go and they would acclimate back into life. And I think heaven was that kind of purpose for that. But it's an interesting part of the book, and it's kind of graphic in some detail. There's a lot of sex in this book and drug use, the thing that shocked me about reading it. Yeah. And you're like, wow, you know, they got pretty deep into that for a minute. I was like, wow, wasn't expecting that. And I, at that earthiness though, once again, the humanity really comes through those pages because it's honest. I found the end of the book, and I don't know how you felt about it, but it's kind of a letdown to think the eternal war and all the sacrifice. I mean, William's life is completely strange. Completely.
Right.
And he'd sacrificed so much, and all those people that died, and just his very humanity, as we like to talk about. And now, you know, his Marigay like buys that ship and goes back and forth. You know, if I can't be your wife, I'll be your nurse, I think is actually what she writes in the I mean, the sacrifices are made, and then for what? Where did they accomplish? I think they're actually going to destroy the Stargate when they came. They're like, we're waiting, you're the last ship, and then we're going to destroy it. I think what man, the new form of man, tells them.
It's fascinating because it's one of those things. I mean, it's a not a trope, but it's there's allusions to it in other places, like Frodo, you know, not getting to stay in Middle Earth, right? Moses not getting to go into the promise. It's they have been heroes in this war that was fought over nothing, and now the war's over, and it's not like they get to go back to the life they knew before war. They just have to find a way to live in the new world.
It's kind of like what in the Firefly movie Serenity, what that assassin for the government tells Malcolm Reynolds, you think I can live in heaven?
Yeah. I'm not going to live there. I'm a monster.
I'm a sinner, man.
But it must be done.
Exactly. And that it must be done. See, you threw down Moses, I threw down Firefly. So there we go.
I think that covers the bases, right?
You threw down the better one. And he's never written anything as good as this. I've kind of picked out his other books and people talk about him, and I really like him. You know, his wife is a really nice person too, from everything I've ever read about them. But this book is like the book that he was supposed to craft. And, you know, his sequel is not very good. It's kind of weird. And I thought, well, you know, I wish we'd gotten another book from another point of view. It would've been interesting to read from another person that fought in other campaigns. Right. I mean, I think this book can still be read today. It can still be enjoyed. And it can still, especially, I remember there was a quote from Chris Kyle, the U.S. Navy sniper that was killed, who actually lived around, you know, is from Texas too. And they had this funeral right here at Cowboy Stadium. I live near Arlington. And I remember him saying that, you know, here he was, and if he was in Iraq and he comes home, he's driving around his pickup and, you know, he's looking for IDs. And yet there's this war going on, people are dying. And he's like, but people are just like hanging out. They're not talking about it. They're not thinking about it. They're going to get ice cream. And I thought, and I've kept that, you know, here's a modern example of what the author, Joe, was saying. You know, that disconnect of service. And we put people out in the space. We do this. That is going to happen. Even if they go out to Mars and they come back, that's still an 18-month trip.
Yeah.
At best. Mm-hmm. And you have 18 months they've lost because they're probably going to be in cryogenic. I mean, can you imagine how long those Colonial Marines lost going out to LV-426?
Right.
You know? I mean, look what could happen to Ripley. Mm-hmm. She lost 57 years. I've seen Aliens one too many times. I can actually quote the amount of years she was out there.
I fundamentally disagree that there's a too many times to watch Aliens.
I'm up to over 100 now, and I think my wife is sick.
Wow.
That movie is fantastic.
Oh, man. That's one of my favorites.
Oh, it's – they actually read – I wish they had read The Forever War, but they read the actors had to read Starship Troopers. Mm. And I think – there are a lot of rumors running around that Cameron was going to get his hands on the Forever War movie, but now Ripley's may make it. Now it's not. Hmm. So it's kind of interesting who might get there. But the Colonial Marine, you know, that thing, you think about them and their culture that exists. I always like to think that there's a little bit of the Forever War in there, that they're kind of a breed apart, you know, because their service to humanity has made them aliens to their own world. And I think William has become that. I mean, he became basically through, you know, forced cloning and homosexuality and all that. He's like the old queer. He's weird. In fact, his soldiers had to learn archaic English to even speak to him.
Right, which I love. One deployment. A nod to linguistics and the fact that language changes.
Yeah. I mean, soldiers, I tell someone who served and someone who didn't by what words they use. I work with a lot of veterans, and I work for a level 2 trauma center as my other job. And I've worked with a lot of veterans, and they have a different lingo. And every profession does. But what it was a subtle nod to something. And there's some of these nods in these books, if you don't read it very carefully, there's some things in it, you're like, it's brilliant. It's layered. It's deep. It's a really deep book. I mean, everybody, and we mentioned this before we started recording, talking about how great Dune is, and you have to be in the right mind to read it. But The Forever War is also an onion. You got to really peel it back, and you can read it one way and read it another way. I think The Old Man's War is a much simpler book. It's a much more straightforward book. Old Man's War has a lot of like, what is war really? What do you pay? There's a pound of flesh what is the quote? There's no unwounded soldier. Mm. And I think that's what The Forever War is trying to make. You know, if we're going to do this, we need to be careful.
Yeah.
And I know that if they ever make a movie of this, I want them to include the Queen song off of Night at the Opera album.
I was listening to that like 10 minutes before we got on the call. Cause I had read that post.
Of me? Did you hear what I was trying to say about it?
Oh yeah. 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 It would definitely fit.
When I read the book, I was thinking, because Brian May is an astrophysicist, and I think that time dilation is, I think in that it's not written about that, but then I listened to that, and I'm like, my God, to have that as a Forever War thing. I'm like, just let me direct it. Just let me write it. Just let me go.
Yeah, exactly.
I've already got the scene for you. call me Ridley. I'm available.
Yeah.
I wish more books dealt with this, and I have wanted to write a military science fiction book about this, but I've always been scared to touch the subject because he did such a good job with it.
Yeah. So we haven't really talked about, I mean, we've mentioned in passing the idea that the kind of shift in humanity towards homosexuality as a population control. And I've definitely read that Haldeman has some regrets in the way he portrayed some of the gay characters. But yeah, I just like, as a straight guy, I don't know what I have to say about those parts and you know, if I'm just imagining offenses that don't exist or you know, how that would hold up for someone who's coming from that perspective. And I just don't know.
Yeah. And I don't either. My brother-in-law is gay and he reads science fiction, and I don't think he is very anti-war. Mm. He has criticized me very openly about writing this site. I've written in the genre. I have a published book, but whatever. And so he was he read it before it was actually published, and he was like, I don't agree with this at all. He would be, the man read L. Ron Hubbard's stuff, so he figured he should write, because I tried to get him to read The Forever War, and he refused. Because if he had read it, we could have asked him what he thought about it. And I don't, you know, and I think that's a perspective to take, because so few science fiction authors would address homosexuality in a futurized setting anywhere close to this. Now that's far different.
Yes.
Even in probably in the 90s, that was getting there. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about gay characters that are key to the plot. They're key to the entire change of humanity mentioned in the book. I mean, it's a key part. Mm-hmm. It's not discussed very much. I don't know if it'll ever come up in the movie, if they make it. It'd be really interesting. It's in the graphic novel extensively. Mm. And you wonder, I don't know what people might think about it, but once again, you have to remind yourself, when was this book written?
Yes.
And him doing that and discussing that, and I've never read that he regrets it, but I mean, I never done any research on it. I can imagine, because now it's like, you know, now that we become a much more enlightened culture about that, you wonder, what was he really trying to say? Was it just like a simple, I mean, he's a scientist basically, and he may come at a more rational point of view than people that are going to get really hysterical about it and, you know, throw flaming toilet paper at him or something.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think it's an interesting perspective, but it makes sense. Yeah. And their world is completely overpopulated and forced, in some ways, forced homosexuality. And we have to remember that, you know, William doesn't have any access anymore. I mean, there's cruises you go out and you're like, well, you're an incurable heterosexual. I think it's what that doctor actually tells him that makes a pass at him when they get drunk. I can't remember her name. This is your only chance, William, take it. It's funny, his name and my name are the first, or similar, so you know, the same name, so it's kind of funny for me to read it. Anyway, I thought about that, and oh, you know, the incurables get put off a middle finger, and that's where they live. I'm like, what is this book trying to say? I mean, it's one of the absurdities of this book, and I think it's unlike Dune, which is weird for weird sake sometimes, and we're not talking about the Lynch, you know, cat in a box kind of thing, just what's in the text. Forever War is a deceivingly strange book. You read it, you reread it, and you're like, wow, this is really in here. Mm-hmm. What? And it works in the context. But you were to read this book out of sections, I don't think it would make any sense to you. You have to like go on this strange little journey, this fantastic journey with William, and you have to look at that. And then when he arrives at the end, it's all the absurdity make it where he exists in a world that doesn't, he's outlived the world he was supposed to live in, which is, he was supposed to die years before. He actually is born, because he's born in 75, I was born in 76, and my family's from New Mexico. So I find it weird when I actually did not remember that about the book, when he was born and where he was born. I'm like, wow, this is just, and it makes you think, you know, he outlived the world he was supposed to live and die in. And now he is the old queer that was nearly stabbed to death at one point, or his own man. And, you know, he's like an incurable heterosexual when, you know, the military that Joe was in persecuted homosexual. And it used to be a way that people get out of service in Vietnam.
Right.
So that's how the drummer for The Doors, John Densmore, that's how he got out of serving in Vietnam. But yet, one of the greatest generals in human history, Alexander, was gay. Mm-hmm. So go figure. It's an interesting perspective. And I would be curious if you wrote this book now, if the book wasn't written, and we're in an alternate reality where he comes back from serving in Iraq, what this book would look like. I would be really curious.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, there is another book written about the Iraq conflict. And I was like, that is strange. You'll Google it and you'll come up with one or the other. I didn't think authors realized to use basically the same title. But I'm so impressed that someone wrote this book, wrote it in the right way, but also committed to its strangeness and took us all with him.
I like it.
I mean, I don't know what your kind of closing thoughts on this book are now that you've reread it several times, but why did you read it? Did you read it because it was part of your project, or did you read it just because I've heard this is a good book?
I've only been doing this for less than 2 years for this podcast. I had at some point kind of set out to start reading more of the classics of the genre. And I think, you know, The Forever War was one that popped up on lists. And I think I saw it flash by on a sale for, you know, $2 or $3 and thought, I've been meaning to read that. And I had read Starship Troopers. That was one my dad really liked. And I had heard that The Forever War was a good counterpoint to Starship Troopers, which I think it is. So I just, it wasn't on a whim, but it wasn't terribly planned either. It was just kind of, well, circumstances has led me to this point. Here I have this book now, and you know, it's nice to knock a classic off.
It is. It's funny. If you were to put, I mean, Starship Troopers, I have a very love-hate relationship with that book. And a lot of people praise it. And I don't think I'm going to get in trouble. I don't think it's as good a book as most people think it is. I've read the book repeatedly. And there's some absurdities in that book. And I'm like, God. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of Robert Heinlein. I'm not a huge fan of him. Because, you know, he hated Asimov. I love Isaac Asimov. He's like a god. He's a titan of science fiction. He's a god. And, you know, he didn't like him. That's why he wrote Starship Troopers, because they were like speaking out against atomic tests. And he was a Navy veteran, Heinlein. And he was like, well, I'm going to write a book you know, that's more hawkish. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this book, and now it is basically stamped and sealed military science fiction. And then there's that movie, the 97 movie, which once again, I have a love-hate relationship mm-hmm. with, that also exists. When I was writing my first military science fiction book, they'd be like, oh, is it going to be like Starship Troopers with the boobs and the guns? I'm like, oh God, go away from me. Yeah. Read The Forever War and come back and talk to me. And I think The Forever War, I'd love to put them, if they had ever talked, I don't know if the two authors had ever talked, Joe and Robert, if they ever been in the same room together. It'd been fascinating to have them like the yin and the yang, because Starship Troopers doesn't have as much honesty about combat and what it does to people. Mm-hmm. Somewhat. But The Forever War like puts that there. And I don't know if it's a World War II generation versus Vietnam generation perspective, which would be pretty deep. Some more out there, some literature student ought to do a compare and contrast paper on the two of those. Free tip. But I think actually might be an interesting thing for me to do, but I think when I was doing the award for the best one, I actually was debating very harshly about Old Man's War, Forever War, Starship Troopers, which gets the award. Right. And for me, I kept coming back, the Forever War is the book because it's honest and real and strange, but it supports that strange with a progression of evolution that William gets to see in his 1,143 year war he got to experience. And I don't know what's going to happen with this book. I worry that a movie's going to ruin it.
No, the book will still exist. Trust me. I have another podcast where we always discuss adapted science fiction. And, you know, I'm the guy who's like, I read the book, show me something different, you know, show me something that's inspired by it, but transcends it in some way. And, so yeah, I'm not sure about an adaptation of The Forever War. If, you know, like you and I, our dads were in the Vietnam generation, right? You know,
my dad served in Vietnam.
And so we understand some of that from people that we know, like from, I had lots of friends whose dads were Vietnam vets. And
yeah.
So that helps me get into, you know, to kind of understand some of the almost allegory of The Forever War. And so, yeah. You know, to make a movie of it now, you'd want to bring it into a more modern context and to kind of speak to the kind of war we have now, which in a lot of ways is sort of the forever war, right? Where it's like, how long are we going to be at war in the Middle East? Forever?
Exactly.
So yeah, I'd be interested to see what it would have to say in an adaptation today.
Because you can't set the book. I mean, I think they're actually, I mean, the book is, I know like 90, you know, he's born in 75, but I know it takes place starts to like in the 90s. The graphic novel is slightly updated in timeline, but now when you listen to it, it's really retro. So what do you do? You know, we have not gotten even close to the technology that's mentioned in the book.
Right.
I don't know. I'd be curious. I don't know if it'll ever get made.
We'll see.
I think, you know, when I saw the movie Avatar, I had a little hope that somebody could put that kind of strangeness to realistic space travel in pieces. Yeah, because they kind of cover a little bit in Avatar.
Yeah, I feel like we've kind of covered final thoughts almost. And so unless you have something else to talk about, we can wrap it up. I think
I would say, you know, and my final thought is, if anyone's listening to this that's on the fence, buy the book, read the book, and then reread it, because this is a book that deserves to be in your mind, live in your heart, because it's a good book and it has great characters. And get the tissues before you read the end of the book.
Yeah,
guaranteed. Guaranteed.
Perfect. I think that's a good place to leave it. So, William, where can people find you?
They can find my collective rambling thoughts with some poor editing on futurewarstories.blogspot.com. You can just search the word Future War Stories on and it'll pop up. That and the political cartoon that was made about the same phrase. And there are tons of thoughts about the Forever War and everything else. And if you're super interested, there's all kinds of articles on the various adaptations of the future of the Forever War, including the stage play, the graphic novels, that kind of thing.
Cool.
So it's a big home for that.
Nice. Well, I will make sure to get any links from you and put them in the show notes.
Awesome. I would really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate that. You know, you're very busy. I honor the work that teachers do. And so the fact that you carved out a little bit of time for me, I really appreciate that.
Well, this was important to me and I really apologize. I mean, I didn't want to seem like a flake. I just, my life is crazy. And then this came up and this opportunity to talk about this book and it was just too important. And I hope that I've done the book service. And I hope that this was good for you too, because I really, this book is important.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, thanks again for joining me. And it was a pleasure talking to you. Bye.
It was fantastic. Thank you.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with William, and I definitely encourage you to check out future war stories. I'll make sure to put links to all that in the show notes. In the meantime, of course, if you want to reach out to me, it's feedback@hugospodcast.com. You can also go to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form. Or you can find me on Twitter @hugospodcast. And if you'd leave a review for us wherever you listen to us, that'd be fantastic. So I think that'll do it for this time. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.